Paycor knows HR teams are under pressure to recruit and retain top talent. You need more than HR tech. You need expertise at the core. Meet Paycor. Our technology saves you time. Our expertise helps you make a difference. Paycor.com/meetPaycor.
Welcome to Creating a Family, a talk about infertility and adoption. Today we're going to be talking about the questions you must ask when choosing donor sperm or choosing a sperm bank. A lot of questions we got on this topic. It's a really good one. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
What term do you use? And certainly people go on the more distancing factor of calling them a donor, certainly not a father, not a dad, although I know from my own personal experience and from a lot of other women, there's always a nervous period of time when a child is young enough to not really care about what the difference is in those terms and doesn't understand them, and they will get all excited if they find out, you know, that there's some details about their dad. And so no matter what, there's going to be a stage in life when your child is going to want to have their own way of articulating who that person is.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am your host and the director of Creating a Family. And you can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. The infertility and fertility journey is a roller coaster, and people often feel so very alone in their struggles. In support of this year's National Infertility Awareness Week, which was last week or 2 weeks ago, a couple weeks ago, Ferring is launching the Talk About Trying campaign to raise awareness of fertility issues and to empower women and couples to seek help sooner. And as you guys know, that is something we talk about a lot here on Creating a Family. Don't spend too much time with your gynecologist. It's important to get to a specialist sooner. The Ferring campaign encourages people to share their personal experiences to help others feel less alone. And they have two opportunities to participate in their Talk About Trying campaign. That's a hashtag. Hashtag Talk About Trying campaign. Okay, the first opportunity is you can share your personal experience on infertility on social media using the hashtag Talk About Trying. For every time the hashtag Talk About Trying is used, through May 11th, 2018, Ferring will donate $1 to Resolve, the National Infertility Association. To share your story with the hashtag Talk About Trying to help others feel less alone and to support Resolve. The second way you could participate is to share your personal fertility journeys. Again, this is always through May 11th, which, guys, is coming up in just 2 days. So you could share your personal journey as part of the Talk About Trying Story Contest. And that's going to be on the, you're going to get more information about it, on the My Fertility Navigator site, which is it's not a new site, it's actually an updated site, and that is myfertilitynav.com/contest. And you would enter a chance to win an all-inclusive weekend getaway for two at the Miraval Arizona Resort and Spa in Tucson, Arizona. You need to also look at the contest rules because, as you would imagine, there are some. And, again, you get that information at myfertilitynav.com/contest. So there, you have two opportunities to share your story, two opportunities to help others. But both of the deadline is coming up on May 11th, so get busy. Stop procrastinating. Get out there and do your thing. Do your sharing. All right, today we're going to be talking about questions to ask when choosing donor sperm. Our guests today are Jane Mattis. She is a psychotherapist. She is the founder of Single Moms by Choice, and that was founded in 1981. Yes, that was not a mistake, 1981. She is also a single mom by choice, and she is the author of a book, Single Mothers by Choice, a guidebook for single women who are considering or have chosen motherhood. We also have Mickey Morissette. She is the founder of the website choicemoms.org, and she is the author of the e-guide, A Choice Mom's Guide no, Choice Moms Sperm Guide. Almost messed that up. Welcome, both of you, to Creating a Family. Thank you so much for being with
Thank
us
you.
Today.
Thanks, Don.
Oh, and let me just mention, everyone, Jane is in Manhattan, and so she's doing her best to keep the noise low, but, you know, Manhattan is not a quiet place, and it doesn't help any that it's kind of warm right now, so she's battling the street noise and air conditioner, although it's sounding pretty good now, so I think we're in good shape. All right, we got a great question. We got a number of questions from our community. But I wanted to start with one because I think her name is Lakeisha. I think I'm pronouncing that right, Lakeisha. And I think she summarizes well a feeling that many women have, or many recipients have. The timing of this show couldn't be better. I am going to be choosing a sperm bank, and I am so overwhelmed. Talk about pressure. I will be choosing one half of my child's DNA. I am afraid to settle on a donor because I'm afraid I'll make a mistake. I'm not even sure where to begin. I think that she is so not alone in this process. Mickey, I'm going to guess that you hear this a lot from people in your community.
Yes, definitely. It is, it's bigger than deciding who you want to date.
It becomes
a bigger deal, and there's a lot, and because there's a lot of choices, it means you can put a lot of thought into it, and anytime you have a lot of things you can think about, the variables, it just makes it feel really complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I wanted to start with talking about the people who are primarily the users of donor sperm and sperm bank fall into three general categories. One is heterosexual couples who are facing male infertility. The next one would be single women who don't have partners, and the next one would be lesbian couples. So we've got those kind of the three general. And it, although I will say that at least from our experience, there are fewer heterosexual couples now than in the past. Primarily due to some advances in infertility and infertility treatment, in particular, intercytoplasmic sperm injection, ICSI, which allows doctors to use, if they've got one sperm, they can sometimes they can fertilize an egg. So anyway, but nonetheless, we still have heterosexual couples who are facing infertility and male infertility and are considering donor sperm. So it occurs to me that some of the factors that people are looking at and some of the concerns might differ depending upon which demographic, which group you fall into. Jane, let's talk first about heterosexual couples. They're facing male infertility, and for whatever reason, either ICSI is not an option, because that can happen where there is absolutely mm-hmm. no sperm, or they can't afford, or they have religious or other concerns about using IVF or creating excess embryos. So for whatever reason, they are considering donor sperm. So from your experience, and this would primarily be probably in your therapy practice, what do heterosexual couples usually look for, and how do they decide, and how might that differ because of the reason that they're coming to donor sperm?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, many of the considerations are the same no matter what. You want a healthy child that has some traits that you think would be beneficial to the child and would help the child fit into the family. But with a married or heterosexual couple, the resemblance to the father is often a big issue because there's more complications in the story for the child when they're told, or sometimes unfortunately not told, that the father, the biological father, is not the social father. But most fathers would prefer that at least the child look like them if that's possible. That's a big concern.
And we will talk about the importance of appearance and things like that in just a bit. So yes, and you actually mentioned the other one that I was thinking of, and that is from my experience in our community, heterosexual couples are more likely to look for an anonymous donor. Now that may be changing, but that certainly in the past we see that there are perhaps more likely to prefer a donor who is anonymous. So, all right, let's shift to, and we're going to talk about anonymous versus ID-identified donors in later as well. All right, let's shift to lesbian couples. What do they often look for when choosing donor sperm? And Jane, I'm going to direct this question to you as well.
Well, it's really not that different, except for, as you mentioned, the possible anonymity concern or wish, depending on which side the couple falls on that. Otherwise, it's not that different from a single woman choosing donor sperm. It's often a decision the couple may have to make in terms of which side of the family the child might resemble. You know, most parents want the child to look like at least one of them. And, you know, it's easier to pick somebody with specific qualities that resemble one or the other parent, but it's harder to get to even imagine a mixture.
And some make the decision that if one of the partner is going to be the carrying parent,
right,
the mom, that they will choose a donor that will resemble the other partner. That is, that's one way to go about it.
Or the opposite, right.
Yeah, or the opposite. You're exactly right. And we actually, I know of it, this is primarily either where infertility is already an issue or money is not a concern, but the couple may choose to use the egg. One mom carries it, and the other mom donates the egg.
That's right.
I have seen that as well, although that certainly increases the cost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Also, I guess the only other thing I would mention is that we see an increased interest in lesbian couples for home insemination, which makes sense. They're trying to demedicalize that what for them is a conception process.
Mm-hmm. And some single women also prefer that for the same reason.
Excuse me, everyone. This is what we call the yellow season. It's also known as allergy season. So I'm going to be hitting my cough button frequently here. I should have a sneeze button as well. All right. Now let's move on to talk about single moms, or single women who are considering using and choosing donor sperm. One question I have for you, Mickey, is do you see that women make this choice more often by themselves, or do they usually bring in friends or family to help them make this decision?
Yeah, you know, everybody kind of approaches things in their own particular way based on personality traits. But one of the things that I've loved hearing about the most are those women that do bring in girlfriends over glasses of wine, and they sit down with the list of variables of possible sperm donors. They narrow somebody, you know, a list of five perhaps, and they narrow it down, and they make it into something that's kind of fun. That's an excellent way to do it. There's others, though, that are very research-oriented and very single-minded in their approach to getting things done, and they might just decide, this is what I'm going to do, here it is. So it'll vary a lot, but I do love the fact that there's women who, certainly the single mothers by choice or choice moms can be very good at networking with each other well prior to the sperm selection process. So they have built in a community, often virtually, and they communicate a little bit about what the variables are, how people made their decisions, not so much to copy that, but just to get a sense of what was important to other people, and also just even things like how many vials should I be getting, and, you know, some of those logistical things. And that's great. I mean, that's what the community is there for.
Yeah, absolutely. And from your experience in your community, choicemoms.org, do you see that women are more likely, single moms, single women, are more likely to choose a donor that resembles them? Or are they looking, from an appearance standpoint, are they looking for something that the donor might resemble somebody they know and care about? Or for couples, they're often looking for resemblance to the non-genetic partner. But what about for single moms?
That would vary. Also, some women on the discussion boards and other places have talked about the fact that they're really looking for I know there's been there was one woman that specifically said she really wanted to have a multiracial family. That was important to her. She lived in a diverse urban area. She specifically wanted to have somebody that wasn't necessarily of the same background that she was. So it can vary, but certainly it does. There's a component of for a lot of women to try to have their child feel like they fit into her own family of origin as much as possible, and so they will, in that case, mirror some of the characteristics.
Okay, excellent. All right. As a lawyer, I can't help but bring up some of the legal things that it's boring, but I think it's important. Jane, do sperm banks generally handle all the legal considerations if the woman is using or the recipient is using a sperm bank? Do they generally handle all the legal issues that she would need to consider, or does she need to think about those in addition, think about the legal considerations in addition to what they're doing?
As far as I know, the sperm banks do take care of all the legalities in the contracts with the donor and with the prospective mother. But many of these contracts haven't been tested, and that is coming to be an issue as people are finding it easier to actually locate the sperm donors via social media, genealogy places, and yet they've signed an agreement not to do that. So this, as far as I know, has not been tested in the courts.
Yeah, I think so, too. I don't know that that specific one has been tested. I'm not sure. I have not heard of it if it has. Mickey, I know that in the Choice Moms e-guide, Choice Moms Sperm Guide, I know that you have a section on legal issues to think about. Anything that you'd like to add at this point for women to go in thinking about at the beginning before they're before they've decided on a specific bank or a specific donor within a bank?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that. One is simply that the banks do have different policies, and it might feel like everybody has the same idea behind banking, but they really have differences around the number of donor limits, and that's not necessarily a legal question, but there are very different policies that people have around how many other donor siblings, as they call them, could exist out there, because there's different, you know, it's not regulated in the way that some people think it might be, and so there are a lot of different policies, which is one of the things that the sperm guide gets into, and then people can kind of make choices based on what's important to them, how the banks handle that. There's also very different numbers in terms of tracking. Couples and individuals are supposed to report back to the bank when there's been a live birth from a donor, but many of them do not actually do that, so therefore that limitation is not necessarily. So there's different policies about how they track that and asking those kinds of questions. And then the other thing that I would just bring into play, which I'm sure we'll probably be talking about more as well, but that a lot of women certainly report that they're not sure they want an open identity donor. I do a survey every year on a different question with the Choice Mom community, and last fall the survey question was about talking to your child about their origin story, how those conversations have gone. And one of the things that women certainly report is they don't feel like it's going to be important to them until that child's actually there, and then they realize they do want to have as much information as they can. And as Jane mentioned, these days I certainly know a couple of offspring who have actually been able to track down their previously anonymous donors. So those conversations happen. What does that person mean? Part of the survey was getting at some of the emotional components of what do you call that person? How do you reflect the donor in your conversations? How often do you have those conversations with your child? And when do they start? So those are all different variables that, you know, again, when you're thinking and you're looking at the database and what they look like and what their skills are and things like that, those are some of the important components that need to be considered as well, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I did want to, excuse me, talk about what some of the policies that sperm banks have that you need to think about. Sperm banks have different policies, and people have different approaches to whether or not what they're looking for. One of the ones you mentioned that I was glad you brought up, and that is the limit on the number of times either a man can donate or the number of children who have been conceived. Jane, from what you see, do most banks limit it on the number of times a man can donate or on the number of children that have been conceived?
Well, they don't really have control over the number of children, even though they may think they do, because, as Mickey mentioned, a lot of these pregnancies are never reported.
Yeah,
so
that's
they
the hard
just
part.
Yeah, they can try to limit the number of donations, and some do. But then the people who want to donate can just go to a different sperm bank. So it's kind of not really something that can be successfully regulated.
Yeah, and I know of a couple of women who intentionally chose a sperm bank that was located on the opposite coast of them, so that with the hope that would mean that the odds that the donor would be from that area, so that their child would have less concern of running into a half sibling in a dating situation, which is not a likely scenario under any circumstance, but it is something that both of these women, and I will say they were both on opposite coasts, and they chose for that reason. So so that's something also to consider as well. Mickey, you mentioned something about, and I hadn't planned on talking about it, but I think it is an interesting thing to bring up, and that is, what do we're going to be speaking of single moms right now, and perhaps lesbian, because I think it would probably differ with heterosexual. What do people call the donor when speaking in specific to their children? And Mickey, answer it if you can with single moms, and then Jane, if you would be able to answer it as to if there's any difference that you see with lesbian couples or heterosexual couples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a specific survey question. We had quite a few questions, but that was a specific one. What term do you use? And certainly people go on the more distancing factor of calling them a donor, certainly not a father, not a dad, although I know from my own personal experience and from a lot of other women, there's always a nervous period of time when a child is young enough to not really care about what the difference is in those terms and doesn't understand them, and they will get all excited if they find out, you know, that there's some details about their dad. And so no matter what, there's going to be a stage in life when your child is going to want to have their own way of articulating who that person is and the term that they hear their other friends using at school. And so it's an uncomfortable sometimes place, but it's also a very inevitable and very common space, and that conversation evolves so much over time. I mean, I certainly know my daughter, when she was young, at one point, because I used a known donor, and so she, at one point when she was 3 or 4, thought, that's her daddy, and we will all go to Disneyland together, because she saw that in a commercial. Well, time goes on and there's no way that she would consider him to be a dad or father term. We actually call him bio dad. And so they will inevitably go through those ages and stages. And Jane's actually been part of a CD we did on talking about that with Jane and a couple other therapists about how you have those conversations and what those inevitable ages and stages are. But but it is an uncomfortable space at times because an adult parent is inevitably going to have a different term for that than their child will at some point. But, you know, things mm-hmm. do develop.
Okay, and Jane, thoughts on lesbian couples or heterosexual couples and how they might differ in what they call the donor?
Right. Well, first of all, there's an obvious difference in that with a heterosexual couple, it's not obvious there was a donor, whereas with the lesbian and single mothers by choice or choice moms, it's kind of obvious there's a missing person, especially once the children learn the biology. So I just want to put in a plug for telling the child when they're a newborn, mm-hmm. which people don't always think about, but is really helpful to the parents, whether mm-hmm. hetero or otherwise, in just practicing using the words that they feel comfortable with, telling the story to the child who has absolutely no idea what you're talking about. And so you can just practice, you know, mm-hmm. and figure out what words work for you. And then I agree with Nikki, the child's going to do their own take on the situation. And it's a matter of really, the children don't get it until they get the biology of how a person is created. When mm-hmm. once they get that, it's a lot easier to talk about the biological father or the bio dad or the donor. And it, of course, also depends on how many other male figures are in the child's life, how big a deal this person who created them with the sperm is in their story. It might be less important, you know, to some children where there are a lot of men who are meaningful in their lives, for example.
Mm-hmm. And if I can just add on what Jane was talking about, starting young, I do find with the Choice Mom survey in particular, we had a couple hundred people respond, and 60% of them said that they start that conversation from birth to two. Mm-hmm. They've already started that conversation because it is, like Jane said, getting used to the story, telling the story proudly. And then eventually storybooks come into play and other things, and they become so comfortable that it becomes just such a natural part of conversation that eventually the questions come from a child, and then it just gets deeper and deeper. I've had a couple different kinds of conversations with my kids over time, and it's one of the things that I love about how conscious our family building actually is that you can have conversations with our kids about how they came to be and why, what's important, how we define ourselves as a family. And, you know, what a mother is and things like that. So,
and what a father is. Yeah.
And what a father is, right. And what a father is not. Let me mention that at Creating a Family, we have a lot of resources on talking with your child about their conception. We hear from people a lot that one of the reasons that they have not told, even though they are at some point planning on telling, is that they don't know or they don't know how to begin. So we have resources that take you from the very beginning on how to do it, and I strongly support what both Jane and Mickey have said about it's easier to start young. And Jane, I know you said your survey said 60% are starting at birth. I'm going to guess that, in fact, there has been some research that's been reported that heterosexual couples are far less likely to be telling their children at all. Jane, have you seen any, like within the last 1 or 2 years, research that indicates the percentages that are of heterosexual couples that are telling or not telling?
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen numbers, but I belong to the American Society for Reproductive Medicine as a mental health practitioner, and their policy is very definitely for the couple or single or, you know, whoever is conceiving with donor sperm to be open from the beginning. And that's not always been the case, but it is now their official recommendation. And many fertility doctors and other practitioners require that the potential mother or couple go for some kind of counseling to discuss and help them understand the reason why openness is so important. And for sure,
yeah,
it's harder for a heterosexual couple to do that because the man has to be on board. And the couples I tend to see in my practice, that is often the issue that brings them in, is that the mother wants to tell the child right from the beginning, and the father is just not comfortable with that because of his own maybe embarrassment or even shame about not being able to provide the sperm.
Oh, and fear. And fear. Fear that his role in the child's
That's
life
right.
will be diminished. You
right.
know, we see that so, yeah, so very
right.
often. All right. I mentioned earlier that the location of a sperm bank does not actually matter. I think that's a surprise to a lot of people, but sperm can be shipped and will be shipped unless you happen to live in the, and even then probably will be shipped. So I think that's a surprise to a lot of people that the location of the sperm bank really doesn't matter. Well, let's talk about something pretty mundane. Let's talk about prices. Mickey, does the price of donor sperm vary? Now, right now we're not talking about if it's being donated altruistically by somebody who is a known donor who is giving you their sperm. We're going to talk about that later. Right now we're just talking in sperm banks. So do the prices vary much?
They do considerably, and the thing that's interesting for me, too, since I do the sperm guide, each year I update the sperm guide. We have about 11 different sperm banks in a chart that we compare some of, you know, how many donors they have, what their limits are, motility promises, things like that, and cost, both of shipping and the vials themselves. And, of course, every year that number is going up. I'm changing every single one of the banks. The numbers go up. A lot of that is, you know, also there's more testing that's needed
mm-hmm.
and required, and that's expensive. So the numbers are going up. They go up fairly consistently, so a bank that's a little bit higher in price is still going to be higher in price, but they go up in the increments. But they range, in the guide the new issued guide for this year, it can be as low as 375, which is unusually low, and then it can be up to closer to $1,000. And again, there's a lot of services that come with that number.
Yeah, sure.
And then there's even another one bank that does a lot of people who will be known very early in a child's life, which is a very different kind of policy. But those donors are much more expensive.
Yeah, we're going to move now to kind of talking about some of the different services that different banks provide that might influence the cost. So let's talk about some of those. One of the services is the ability to provide how much information they provide and how personalized the information is. I'll just say it that way. Jane, can you talk to us some about how different banks are able to give parents a feel for the personality of the donor,
mm-hmm.
because I think it differs depending on the bank.
Sure. Some give the actual donor speaking. They ask the donor to make a tape recording that the potential mother or mother and father can use to help pick the donor. Some people really appreciate hearing the donor's voice and getting more of a sense of the personality than you can get from any piece of paper. Some give childhood photos. I believe some give adult photos, but I'm not sure about that. Maybe Mickey or Dawn can correct me. And some also give much more information at a higher price, or more basic information at a lower price, for example. Those are some of the differences.
Mickey, some other differences, and then Linda, let's talk about pictures. But first, before we move into pictures, can you? What are some of the other ways that sperm banks distinguish themselves on trying to identify the personalities involved of the donors?
Yeah, there's those staff impressions and you know those sort of interviews that people on staff have with a donor, and so then they can give you a sense of what they are like, how they might match, not just appearance-wise, but other characteristics that are important to you, maybe related to family and things like that. So those are all things meant to really help the customer. And again, it's so much more customer service-oriented than it used to be in this way, to make the customer feel a little more assured of what they're getting. Now, of course, I mean, it has to be said that there's, you know, you forget that there's no guarantees, the genetic anomalies that can happen, the donor who doesn't know when they're 20, 22, what kind of health concerns there are later on, things like that. Because those are, you know, it's those are variables. And but there are certainly ways that the banks are going much deeper into. Some of them have started to just specialize only in open identity and identity release donors. But there too, the policies will be very different about how they promise to be able to either track that donor, keep track of that donor over time, what that contact may or may not be. Down the road. So those are all important questions that will vary a lot in the banks, but they are certainly being much more able to have more open identity donors than they used to.
Can I just add that a very recent new kind of information that is available is psychological testing, which was unheard of until fairly recently. And is now becoming, I think pretty soon every bank is going to be doing it, if they're not already, because that's the one big area that does have a genetic piece that was never addressed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting. So you think that, well, let me ask this, how common is it right now? And is it just a basic kind of personality profile test, or how in-depth is the, Jane, how in-depth is the testing? What do you mean by testing?
Well, it's more than just a simple, obvious kind of test that anybody could cheat on. But it's I really don't know how detailed it is, but it's considered acceptable, you know, more than like a pop quiz or something you could give to yourself.
Yeah.
But it is fairly new, and as soon as, because there were a number of reports of some donors having had very extreme psychiatric histories that were never revealed until it was obvious from, you know, later information, either from the donor or the children, that it was a problem. So in the face of potential lawsuits or maybe actual lawsuits, the banks are now pretty much making sure that that's included.
Yeah, and I guess I would just say that part of the reason, again, that banks are doing as much as they are with customer service is there have been anomalies that have become more public. And a big spur to that is the fact that because women can now communicate online with each other and find each other through half-siblings and donor registries, there's much more conversation that can detect those patterns. And so I think it's going to be a growing area of concern for banks is how to screen things that you can't necessarily screen for, but it becomes a problem, a public relations problem later on sometimes. A lot of that, though, can be resolved by how open they are at what point with customers. And, you know, that kind of bank policy varies a lot.
It does, and, you know, the whole area, because as we go back to what Lakeisha said at the very beginning, you know, this is such a huge decision, and the more information that's available, the more we want, because, I mean, it's almost human nature that you know, the more information we have, the less scary this decision is, or at least that is one way to think about it. And a whole interesting area is the whole new genetic testing, And that's got some significant, I've talked with different sperm banks who are really struggling with this because, you know, how invasive is that for the donor? I mean, they may not want all of this information. They may not want to know it themselves. It's, you know, from a genetic testing. And others, and particularly I think a lot of recipients, are very interested in as much genetic testing as they can get. So there's not a right answer, but I suspect there will be more and more genetic testing, although I think there's a lot of issues that's not easy to think through as to, you know, from the genetic testing standpoint. But Mickey, are you seeing more genetic testing being offered by banks?
Yeah, in fact, I know there's a one of the banks that I've known for a few years, and I have to admit I don't know the depth of what this new system is, but they do have a deeper profile system, not necessarily the psychology, but related to genetic testing of different variables. I don't really know how it works, but I do know it's something they're very excited about that they're being able to offer to clients. It's kind of new. It also goes hand in hand with that there's no guarantees when you're talking about genetics in any way, and so there might be some assurances, but it's also important for all women to remember that there's still, you know, we don't even know our own genetic histories in as much depth as we might end up knowing the donors and the combination of egg and sperm.
Absolutely.
And the DNA involved. So there's always going to be variables, and you know, it can feel like if we're using science that we're going to be able to predict the genetics and other things of the child. But it's, you know, it's like it just evolves.
I'm so glad you said that. I think that the general public often imagines that we can know everything through genetics, and the reality is we don't. And not all these tests are readily available, and so it's there is a stepping out on faith one way or the other. Here's a question that we got from Fiona, and it relates back to something that I think you said, Mickey. Jane, I'm going to direct this to you. Fiona says, I'm going to be a single mom, and I think I may have only one child because of finances and work demands. I think it would be great if my child was able to have contact with half-siblings. My family and friends think this is a bad idea. I also don't know if that is possible with sperm banks or only in the national forum that you mentioned. I think when she says the national forum, I think she's talking about the donor sibling registry, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jane, some thoughts for Fiona. Now, she's thinking of this in terms of, I think, if I'm reading her question correctly, in selecting a sperm bank, wanting to be able to connect with others who have used the same donor, or rather than she wonders if the only option is to go with donor sibling registry.
Well, each of them, the donor sibling registry and the sperm banks, have different ways of helping or not helping with the connection. On the donor sibling registry, it's kind of a crapshoot as to whether or not other people who use the same donor or possibly even the donor are registered on there. The sperm banks in the past have been not that helpful in helping with the connection. Part of the problem is also, as we mentioned earlier, the non-reported pregnancies. You know, the pregnancies that are not reported, obviously you can't find out about them. So, but also there are Facebook groups that are popping up on many sibling groups or donor sibling groups or dibbling groups. There's a terminology, you know, question there too. But people are finding ways to find other people who've used the same donor and have offspring that are related. And as a therapist, I am very much in favor of this. I don't know that it always works, because even in our own personal families, we know there are people who click with each other and people who don't. But I think it might be worth having that information and either pursuing it or not pursuing it, depending on how you and your child feel about having a more extended genetic family. Can be wonderful.
Mm-hmm. I do know that there are at least one, but probably some sperm banks that do have forums, and they have sub-forums based on specific donors, so that they're actively encouraging families to connect if they choose. And it's a safe and private space with which to do that. So I do know that, at least some banks are doing that. If
more
not
and
all.
More, yes.
There had been some talk I'd had over a period of time with different people, therapists and bank representatives, about having a national registry, and I think some of this individual bank is partly to be able to control that a little bit. So I, you know, I myself am kind of disappointed we're not moving in the direction of a more of a multiple bank registry, because as Jane mentioned earlier, sometimes. You know, you don't know how many places a donor's been to and things like that. It's just one of those factors. But at any rate, it is something that has been the banks have been trying to resolve in their own ways. And I also think openness is helpful. And some women do decide that they really want to have these dibblings involved. And we've had some resource material about that as well, making those connections or not making those connections.
And let me tell everybody the term dibbling is what they're using, and you didn't mishear that, and she's not, she doesn't have a lisp, so she, it's donor-sibling combination, dibbling. Half-sibling is sometimer, but donor-sibling is, and so it's been, some have shortened it to dibbling, and so that's where that's coming from. I just didn't want people to think, Mickey, that you couldn't speak correctly. I think Jane also mentioned it as well.
Yep.
Yes.
Let me remind everyone that you're listening to Creating a Family, and today we're talking about questions you should ask when you are considering donor sperm. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not and would not happen without the generous support of our partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient and recipient community. One of our great sponsors is Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of the prospective sperm donor to provide the client with a personalized, safer donor match list. In addition to donor sperm services, Manhattan Cryobank also offers a full array of andrology and fertility preservation services as well. All right, I promised that we would talk some about the ways that that pictures are handled by different sperm banks, and how people. And what's interesting to me is the importance of pictures that differ on the recipients. You know, we are all individuals, and for some people, it's really, really, really important. For some, only want to have childhood pictures. For others, they don't really care about childhood. They only want adults, so adult pictures. So, Mickey, how do sperm banks differ in how they handle pictures of the donors?
Yeah, and I haven't specified in my chart what pieces each bank have, but what I've done is I provide a link that jumps to those places, because those change a lot over time. I do know there are more and more, and again, I think it's consumer requests, and to be competitive, more banks are starting to offer those adult photos. It does mean to me that, you know, with face recognition technologies and things, that you're pretty much doing any kind of anonymity or waiting until age 18 with open identity, you know, that kind of goes out the window for those that are earnest. And a lot of offspring actually are not. I know that with the Sperm Bank of California, where they have a lot of help in connecting, a lot of offspring aren't really ready to do that until maybe they're having their own children later on in life. And so it's not an automatic at 18, here I go. But certainly the adult photo thing just kind of means, you know, here, we're going to find you. I find it interesting that banks are willing to go there. The other thing I'll just bring into play is I have interviewed past anonymous donors and also those that have made connections with their offspring over time. And one of the variables that I think is also important for us to remember is that after those donors have become adults and married and had kids of their own, their openness when they were younger has other people in to be factored in when they're 30, 40, 50 years old.
Exactly.
So that's just something to remember, too.
Yeah, and we're going to circle back. I'm sorry, just Jane, did I interrupt you? You were getting ready to say something?
I just
nope.
was going to add that we really have learned a lot from the adoption community, and much of what we're going through and learning all over again is what they went through in terms of openness of adoption or non-openness.
Mm-hmm.
Not all kids mm-hmm. are interested, as Mickey mentioned.
No, and you're exactly right. I was creating a family. We have a foot in both worlds, and it seems to me that this area is an area of such overlap. Let me pause now to bring in another guest, Dr. Grace Santola. She is a nationally and internationally recognized specialist in laboratory andrology and reproductive tissue banking. She has published over 40 peer-reviewed scientific articles, over 70 abstract presentations at national conferences, and 26 book chapters. Welcome, Dr. Santola. You are one busy lady.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we're bringing you in specifically to talk about quality control measures because we got a question on this, and I think it's a question that a lot of people have, particularly when they get closer to actually deciding. Let me read Rowena's question first. She said, I bought a vial of sperm from a sperm bank, and they said the sperm was a specific number and swam very fast. When my doctor tested the sperm before my artificial insemination, it didn't rank as well. I was so frustrated. I didn't get pregnant, and I wonder if that's the reason why. How can I make sure that the sperm is as good as they say it is? So let's talk, if you could, Dr. Santola, if you could walk us through briefly, what are some of the different tests for quality that are done routinely by sperm banks, and why might that differ when it, or does it very often differ if it's tested at the doctor's?
It happens very infrequently, first of all. Let me assure her that it does happen very infrequently. And the process goes as follows. Basically, when the donor comes in to donate, he provides a specimen, and usually within about 30 to 45 minutes, the lab will then take that specimen and do a sperm count and a motility, do some checking, and then proceed with the process to do the freeze. There's always a test vial that is thawed at about 48 hours after the initial freeze, and that gives the lab a handle on what we would expect if any of the remaining vials from that date would be thawed. So we do a count and a motility, and you do the calculations, and you can say, okay, now if any of those vials were thawed, we would expect to have 20 million motile sperm, or we would expect to have 75 million sperm, but 30% motility, and you would make the calculation. Now, occasionally what might happen is that a vial didn't get aliquoted fast enough, completely enough, so a vial might have less in the vial. But most often what I find happens is that the way a sperm lab, an andrology lab, would do a count and a motility is quite different than what a physician's office might do. They don't use the same chamber that a lab might use to do the counting. Sometimes a doctor's office just looks at it quickly on a slide and makes a guess. However, what I would recommend to Rowena is that as soon as this happens, if it does happen, the sperm bank should be notified. And they will take the information from the doctor's office and see what they did for their count. I mean, we can expect maybe a 20%, up to a 20% difference between the way one place would do a count and the way a sperm lab would do a count. So we take that into consideration and discuss it with the client or the doctor's office and make amends for that if there wasn't a significant difference.
So
different than the guarantee.
So sperm banks give a motility guarantee where they say you can expect, and a number guarantee. You know, you expect X number of sperm and we expect to have a motility of X. So if the testing that's done at the doctor's office is not the same as the testing that's done in the andrology lab, is it not? Is it less precise or more precise, Dr. Santola?
At the doctor's office, it clearly would be less precise because they wouldn't be as experienced with doing checking sperm count and motility that a sperm lab would be. But what I want to point out and what I think is the most important is not necessarily the motility itself, but the numbers of motile sperm that are present when that vial is thawed. And I'll give you an example. If we had a count, 50 million, 5-0, that is 50 million, and a motility of 50%, that would be 25 million motile sperm, correct? Half of 50 million. But if we had 100 million sperm and a motility of 25%, that would still be a 25 million motile sperm. So the whole key is not the actual percent motility, but the numbers of motile sperm, or some refer to it as the total motile count, or the motile concentration. That is what is important. Labs generally guarantee, depending on if it's one prep or another prep, 10 million motile sperm or 15 million motile sperm or 20 million motile sperm. And the way a doctor's office would count that, it might be off a little. It might be 18 million. How different is 18 million than 20 million? Not that much different. But I definitely recommend that anyone that has something like this happen, they should either themselves or the doctor's office immediately contact the sperm bank.
Let me bring Mickey in on this. Mickey,
go ahead.
Do sperm banks differ very much, very significantly, on what their total motile count or their motile concentration for what they are guaranteeing for their samples? I mean, for their sperm donors. Or is that pretty universal between sperm banks?
It's fairly universal because, again, they're trying to be competitive, but one of the things that will happen and one of the things in our chart is that some banks promote the fact that they have a higher average. But, again, you know, as the doctor was pointing out, you know, if you look at how they're calculating that, that might make all of the difference. So, yeah, generally everybody's going to guarantee that they'll have 10 million per milliliter, I believe it is. There's also cc's, so I don't know quite how those measure differently, or vials. You'll have a base of 10 million. Some will go up, and, you know, according to our chart, will go up to 26 million on average. But, yeah, again, you have to kind of look at how they're determining that.
Yeah.
And
okay.
I would agree that is very important how it is being determined. And just to clarify, milliliter and cc are the same thing.
Okay.
And again, you have to look at the entire package insert that comes with the vials, because vials will have a half of a milliliter or 3/4 of a milliliter, and they might guarantee, say, 15 million per milliliter, but if there's only half of a milliliter there, you would have to multiply it times half. or if there's 20 million. So you have to look at all of the data, and definitely if there's a concern, the sperm bank should be contacted and they can explain.
Okay, excellent. All right, and we've talked around this topic throughout this interview, and that is the advantages and the disadvantages of identified donor, or it's also called open ID donor or ID release donor, called different things, versus an anonymous donor. Jane, I'm going to guess that you have an opinion on this as to the advantages or disadvantages of either option. So I'm going to give you a chance to share your opinion.
Absolutely. One of my favorite books is a very old book called Lethal Secrets. And the title pretty much says it. I think in terms of good emotional health, secrecy can be lethal, and particularly when it comes to family secrets that have to do with the child's identity. So I do think that although for some parents it's hard to really talk about this kind of stuff because they weren't familiar with it to the degree that many of us who are on this, but we really need to get comfortable with it and then be able to talk about it with our children and extended family.
We just did about 2 weeks ago, an article on, I think the title was, The One Thing You Must Know If You're Going to Use a Donor. And it profiled two different scenarios, two different real-life cases that have recently happened. One of a woman who found out, actually it was a non-donor situation. It was her mother had an affair, but she found out about it in a basic biology 101 freshman year course when they were doing a Punnett square on blood type. And her blood type, it would be impossible, according to this Punnett square. Mm. And she found out, and somebody else in the class tweeted the entire thing. So we have the tweets, you know, coming in. We took off identifying information. And the other real-life story was recently happened when somebody used one of the over-the-counter, you know, mail-order DNA tests and they found out that their parents had used a donor, but she was originally knew that something was wrong because there was no Jewish ancestry, and her father was very proud of his Jewish roots. And then she found somebody who was a very close relative, and she reached out to that person and said, "Oh, who is this? You know, and we have this person in common." And it turned out that was the donor who had donated. It was this, the person that she had contacted was his brother, who had given in college, had donated in college, and hadn't even thought about it. I think that the reality is, and this is my opinion, but the reality is that there's really no such thing anymore of an anonymous donor. It's in many ways it's only a matter of when it feels that way to me. Mickey, would you agree with that, or am I overstating it? Do you think?
Yeah, and you know, I would add my brother was adopted, and as an adult, he really resented the fact that he was not able to. He was not given the rights to any information about his identity, and you know, there was nothing he could do about it. And you know, when you think about your child older and then having their own children and all of that, you know, it is naturally, it's their origin story. And while we can't guarantee that information is going to be very full with an open identity donor, part of it is having that conversation with your child that you did as whatever you could to try to help facilitate that. So,
and Jane, do you see, we at least see now that people are more willing to say that they think they should be telling their children. But I've wondered if we're seeing an associated increase in people who are actively seeking out open identity donors. And keep in mind that open identity is a different, defined differently, whether or not that's when the child is 18 or whether there is a medical reason sooner. And, and I think as Mickey pointed out, just let me say that one of the questions that people absolutely should ask if you're looking for an open identity donor is how is tracking going to be done? How proactive are the sperm banks going to be in tracking, and how much help they will give in facilitating contact? So those are some things to think about. But now let me ask the question, which is, are you seeing people move towards more towards open, or just there's still a fear and there's a desire for anonymous?
It's certainly, there's still a fear. There are people who are just terrified that if a second parent or biological parent is found, that somehow the child will no longer love the social parent who raised them, or the mother in the case of a single parent family. There is definitely the fear, but there is more and more information out there which can allay the fear to some degree of people who have been open, whose children have found the donor. And, you know, it's a very individual thing. Some children get really involved with the donor and want to get very involved with donors, and some don't. So it's really, I mean, I can't emphasize how a comfort level with all this can help in discussing it. And if you can discuss an issue, it is less likely to be problematic in the long run.
Yeah, thank
you.
Could
I interject
here? Yeah, please.
From the standpoint of the sperm bank, and this is a very complex topic, as you've alluded to. We could talk for hours on this. And I think the issue is what you're trying to say is, do you tell the child that they were conceived with donor sperm or not? And then secondly, if you do tell them, are they able to find out the identity or information about that sperm donor? And if it's a purely anonymous, you get a lot of information about that donor. You'll get ethnic group. You'll get medical and social history. You'll get all the physical characteristics, but you won't get their name, okay, and number.
Yes.
And there's some reasons for that. You know, donors do this when they're young and in college, and as you indicated earlier, they aren't thinking perhaps when they're 40 or 50 or 60, or they're having their own children, that someone is going to knock on their door and say, hey, I'm one of your children. That can be devastating to everyone, even the child, because they're going to see if someone doesn't want to know them. So I think that I would agree completely that it depends on perhaps your relationship with your child. It depends on, you know, how much information is revealed. It depends on if you're a married couple, you know, heterosexual couple versus same-sex couple versus a single woman. Each one has different issues. And anonymous versus open identity. Yeah, it's very complex, very difficult.
And if
it
I
is.
Have time to
go ahead,
if I have time to just say, so several years ago, when my son was probably about 10, and he knew we had a known donor, and we were going to that city, and he said, "I want to meet him," and so we did meet him, and it was mostly because my son wanted to shake his hand, see what he looked like, and then that was it. He really didn't.
Uh-huh.
He didn't need more than that. He just wanted to say he had met him, and he was able to do so. So that was cool.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
And your point's well taken. Is that we can't anticipate what it is in this case. What it is that your son, what was it that he was seeking? What was it that was going to satisfy his? And it may change as he gets older too. He's, you know, that's the other thing. Yeah, and his donor, you know, what his desires are, as Dr. Santola said, it is complex, and it is an evolving issue. Let me break for a moment to mention another one of our partners. This is IntegraMed Fertility. They are the largest network of fertility practices in the country. They combine the latest innovations in reproductive science with compassionate and customized treatment plans, and the IntegraMed practices are able to provide the very best possible care. And you can go to their website, IntegraMed.com, to find one of their practices, one of their clinics near you. Thank you so much, Mickey Morissette, Jane Mastis, and Dr. Grace Santola, for being with us today to talk about questions and what's important, what factors should you consider when you are choosing donor sperm. To get more information about Jane, you can go to buy her book, first of all, Single Mothers by Choice, a guidebook for single women who are considering or have chosen motherhood. And you can buy that. It's available on Amazon, I believe, as both a paperback and a Kindle version. Or you can go to her website, singlemothersbychoice.org, to get more information on Mickey Morissette or her website, choicemoms.org, or her Choice Mom's Guide to Sperm. Go to her website, choicemoms.org. That's a mouthful there for me. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I will see you next week.
Now at the Home Depot, save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like the Samsung stainless steel side-by-side refrigerator, just $9.98. You save $300. It's big enough to hold 25 bags of groceries. Unload those, and if that makes you thirsty, you'll really love the external ice maker and water dispenser. Today is the day for doing. Spring Black Friday savings now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. See store for details, valid through April 17th.